Good morning and welcome to our fourth and final webinar in our series on volatility in agriculture. The slide set on the screen shows the team that is implementing the webinar series, and thanks to the effort of these individuals and the institutions they represent, we've been able to deliver this program for you. My name is Ramiro Lobo. I'm a Small Farms and Agricultural Economics Advisor with the University of California Cooperative Extension in San Diego County. Ag in Uncertain Times is a webinar series designed to help producer meet the challenge of today's uncertain economy. This morning is our last webinar, and we're looking at volatility in the fresh fruits and vegetable markets, and also we'll provide some tools, some management tools with an emphasis on food safety. Today's speakers are Dr. Roberta Cook, a cooperative extension marketing economist with the Department of Agricultural and Resource Economics in the University of California, Davis, and Dr. Kinda Curtis with the Department of Applied Economics, where she works as an associate professor and extension economist at Utah State University. We ask that we want to make this series interactive, and we ask that you please enter your questions in the chat pod that's as described in the slide that you see on your screen. To ask a question, you click inside the box and type your question. Once you're done typing, please click the button to send the question, and it will be presented only to the speakers. Some past webinars can be found at the Ag in Uncertain Times website. You can access them by following the link on your screen. The webinar's recordings and slide sets are available for your use in your local programs. We also want to hear from you, and we will be sending you, for those of you who have provided your emails and have attended in past seminars, we will send you a survey asking for feedback and perhaps evaluating the seminar series that we have presented. The team is planning additional webinars for the spring, and if you would like to be notified of these webinars, please send us an email to the address that appears on your screen. That's westrme@wsu.edu. There are also other resources available on the internet for you to use with your clientele, and one of them is the meatnetextension.org. The screen and the web address appears on your screen. I want to alert you also that the full screen toggle, the full screen button at the lower left corner of your screen, allows you to toggle between your entire screen or viewing the presentation and the chat window at the same time. We now want to hear from you, and we'd like to for you to answer some of the questions that will appear on your screen. Please respond to the poll. This will help us plan future activities. Please tell us about yourself. What is your primary occupation? We also would like to know what region of the country you are located in. Thanks for the response. Now, just to get a better idea of the number of people attending, would you tell us, including yourself, how many individuals are participating in this webinar from your home or office? Now, our first speaker this morning is a Dr. Roberta Cook, and Dr. Roberta Cook is a cooperative extension marketing economist in the Department of Agricultural and Resource Economics at the University of California, Davis. She has a PhD in ag economics from Michigan State University, and at Davis she conducts applied research and industry outreach programs focusing on marketing and international trade of fresh fruits and vegetables, including studies on international competitiveness and trends in consumer demand and food distribution. She currently serves on the board of directors of Ocean Mist Farms and Nature Ripe Farms, and since since 2003, she is a faculty director of the California Agribusiness Executive Seminar program, co-sponsored by the Department of Agricultural and Resource Economics and the College of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences at the University of California, Davis, and Wells Fargo Bank. Now, I see that Roberta's slides are in, and with that, Roberta, take it away, and welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ramiro, and good morning to everyone. It's a pleasure to participate in this excellent series of workshops. And when you talk about fresh fruits and vegetables, you're talking about products that are shipped in very close to the product form that they're consumed in. And so they're very directly impacted by overall trends occurring in the food distribution system as a whole. So I thought I would start with some comments on some of the top grocery trends that we're observing. One of the things that remains the case, less so than it was when we first went into the recession, but still restraint has become the new normal for consumers. People are more cautious about what they put in their grocery carts. And when you interview consumers about this, especially in 2009, what people were reporting is, I only buy what I need. And, you know, that would imply people were buying a lot more food than they actually needed, and that may seem strange. But on the other hand, people would err on the side of caution of making sure they had the product at home if they needed it. When you look at crops that are perishable, like fresh produce, that means if you buy too much, you throw them away. And so all of a sudden, people became much more focused on what they were putting into the garbage can. And so the first half of 2009, we actually had a reduction in the actual quantity purchased of fresh fruits and vegetables in retail channels. That has since turned around. But still, this restraint is a factor in the system. And people are very focused on getting value for the products that they do purchase. It's not that people are systematically trading down in terms of the quality of products that they buy, but they're focused on getting the best price for the quality that they are paying. And one of the ways that that is manifested is through the channel blurring phenomenon. This is a phenomenon that has been ongoing over the last 20 years, and that's where there's more competition with conventional retail chains, supermarket chains, in terms of the store formats that operate in the grocery system. So that means more super centers led by Walmart, more limited assortment formats such as Trader Joe's, such as Aldi's, which is very much a low price format. Save a Lot is another example of a low price limited assortment format. And of course you have the high end as well, Whole Foods, which had grown during many years in our system to compete with conventional supermarket chains. So that channel blurring phenomenon is something that is not new, but really became even more accentuated, club stores as well. And people started shifting more, even more of their purchases, at least a portion of them, to these other lower price formats in this case during the recession. Now, people have also changed many strategies for how they buy food, including reversing a long-term decline in coupon usage. Coupon usage has been growing since throughout 2009 and continues to experience growth. And so people are really focused on the prices that they pay today. So that means that retailers have had to become more focused on prices, and retailers have been reducing prices to consumers. So obviously, if value is a top priority for shoppers, it makes it a top priority for retailers. That puts downward pressure on prices, and that goes all the way back through the food distribution system to growers. Now, one of the other things that's significant is that as retailers have tried to figure out how they can reduce costs, they have focused a lot on the assortments that they offer, recognizing that whereas in the past you never would reduce assortments because that was viewed as a way that you would alienate consumers, during the recession, that has become exactly the trend, is to try to focus on the stock keeping units that you have and to rationalize them. In some cases, retailers have been reducing them by 10 to 15%. That is a strategy that they use to decrease inventory costs, which are very significant for chains. So obviously that has an influence on suppliers, especially in the fresh cut category when we're talking about the fresh produce department and also for specialties. Now, both of these trends of value for shoppers and value for retailers are contributing to the development of store brands and private labels. That is especially impacting fresh cut within the fresh produce department and is starting to impact some of the commodity products. Grocery consolidation had happened a long time ago, at the end of the 1990s, and has really stabilized over the last decade. But already then in the system, what we've been dealing with is fewer larger buyers than a couple of decades ago, even relative to 15 years ago. And in addition, now what we're seeing is that there's smaller store formats that are growing. Tesco, with their fresh and easy format, Tesco being one of the largest food retailers based in England, entered the U.S. system a couple of years ago with a smaller store format. And most of the conventional grocery chains have been introducing smaller store formats. Walmart has as well. So we have big firms. But at the same time, we also have a growth in smaller store formats. And that's also related to this SKU rationalization trend, where many retailers are recognizing that that a conventional supermarket that had like 55,000 products probably doesn't need that many if they really understood the consumers that they were serving. And they probably would be more efficient and could still meet consumer demand with around 35,000 products. But in order to achieve that, you need better application of information technology. And in the grocery industry as a whole, information technology has not been applied as effectively as it could be. For example, lack of effective use of the data that is obtained on consumers through customer loyalty cards. Data has not been effectively used at the shipper level and has not been shared as it should be between buyers and suppliers. And so there are great opportunities there through the application of technology to improve that, and we would expect that trend to continue to unfold over the next decade. And again, the recession has just made it apparent how important it is to totally understand costs when you're operating with lower margins at all levels of the system. Now, for retailers, one of the ways that they can make progress is if they can do a better job of store clustering so that they understand what the assortments should be for stores that are located in specific types of neighborhoods where consumer behavior is different. So even for the same format, you can have different neighborhoods where you should be offering different assortments, and they really have not fine-tuned that. As all of that unfolds, of course, that means that that's going to influence what shippers are selling to those retailers. So it's critical for the industry as on the supply side. All right, so now I want to just make sure that when I use a term that I'm going to be using a lot, shippers, that everyone knows what I mean. I realize that all of you are not as familiar with the fresh produce industry. So basically, when people ask me how growers are marketing, what I say is that most growers are not marketing. Of course, you do have growers who are selling directly to consumers through farmers markets and roadside stands and other direct-to-consumer channels, but that probably only represents about 1-2% of total sales of fresh produce. Most sales of fresh produce are moving through shippers who are generally family-owned. There are exceptions. For example, Dole is a leading exception. But most are still family-owned, and they are generally forward-integrated grower shippers. So that means they're growers who became large enough with their own volume to be able to invest in marketing infrastructure. And as buyers became larger, they were looking for suppliers who were larger in order to come closer to matching their scale. And so grower shippers have increasingly sourced from additional growers in order to assemble more volume. While not all shippers are forward integrated grower shippers, some are just shippers that don't have any kind of position in growing. They don't control land. They're just marketing for other growers. The most are forward integrated grower shippers. But really, it's probably just cleaner to call them shippers because that includes both. Now, growers and shippers are generally price takers. They typically are not large enough to set prices. Growers are receiving the residual of the market price that is obtained for their product on any given day in the marketplace that the shipper is selling it for, less a series of charges that the shipper includes on the bill, and that's marketing charges, it's pick, pack, and harvest, palletization. For some crops, you have cooling, and there can be a variety of other different types of handling charges. The shipper has incentives to continue shipping if they're at least covering the variable costs for operating all of these or for providing all of these different types of services. And oftentimes, shippers have profit centers built into many of these different services that they're providing. And, of course, if you make a commitment to buyers, you don't want to short them. That's one of the things you really want to avoid. So shipping will continue and go down to variable prices when markets are long. And so, therefore, sometimes there is no return to the grower, and production costs may not be recouped for certain periods of the year, depending on which weeks you are shipping and where you're located. So that's a very important factor within the fresh produce world, and I want to talk a little bit more about that later. Now, if we look at these grower-shipper entities, you see at the bottom that they control harvesting crews. That's a critical element in this whole system because if you're going to be providing the production of growers that are located in different areas or even in the same region at the same time, but all shipping through the same firm with the same brand, you need to have consistency of quality. And one of the ways that shippers achieve that frequently is by controlling the harvesting crews that go into different growers' fields. Now, in the past, if markets were short, you could freely source from outside growers. But because of the growth in food safety requirements today, that is more limited. And while outside sourcing does still occur in short markets, shippers are very careful today to use only outside growers that have already met all of the third-party food safety certification systems that they require for their affiliated growers. And those requirements are employed throughout the industry regardless of where the products are grown. So whether it's coming from Mexico or Chile or anywhere else in the world, a large grower shipper is imposing those same requirements on all of its growers because obviously their brand is at stake. So more recently what has happened in the industry is that there's been a lot more investment of these shippers in the sales and marketing area. So it's no longer just men sitting on a sales desk talking to a buyer on a daily basis. Now they're beginning to develop many more services for retailers and more sophisticated types of marketing programs. So I want to talk more about that so that they can better serve the needs of all of these different types of entities that you see in the graph. And that's something that presents a lot of potential going forward for better coordination of supply and demand. Now, perishability is the key characteristic that really influences how fresh produce markets work. For most crops, there are obviously exceptions like apples and oranges, but for most crops, you have limited storability, and products are often harvested and shipped daily. That's definitely the case for leafy greens and really for most products within fresh produce. The production regions are shifting seasonally, and that is a very intense management issue. They're constantly subject to weather shocks affecting both supply and demand. So if you're shipping daily and something happens to that affects quality or that affects the supply available in a particular region that's being shipped from, then you're all of a sudden going to have a spike in market prices as a rule. But demand can also change very quickly, and that depends on what's happening with the weather in different parts of the country. So you can have the same supply and prices can decrease or increase substantially at the FOB level, depending on what consumers are doing at any given time. Now, price volatility, of course, made firms very reliant on the spot market. And in general, what we could say, I mean, I started at UC Davis in 1985, and basically there were a few risk management tools beyond geographic and product diversification, with geographic diversification being really the key strategy. Obviously, you don't have futures markets in fresh produce. But something began to change with the introduction of Walmart supercenters into the food distribution system. And Walmart, because they were new in fresh produce, they came in with a totally different model, and that was that they wanted to work on a partnership basis with suppliers. They were willing to share information with their suppliers, which conventional retailers would never do. And they wanted to utilize suppliers to help them market the products. And they did that by setting up a retail link system where their suppliers, their preferred suppliers, had access to the data on movement of their products through any distribution system, distribution center of Walmart that a shipper was supplying. And then the shipper was responsible for renewing, replenishing the inventory. So vendor-managed inventory replenishment became this new trend. And what they were focused on was not on getting the lowest price on any given day, but rather having these stable suppliers and utilizing them to help grow demand for the product. So they introduced contracts. Now you say, you know, with all this volatility, how do you manage contracts? And it was very challenging. But gradually over time, contracts have become used to a much wider extent in the food industry by conventional retailers as well. However, it varies a lot by crops. For some crops, contracts are still not very used at all. For crops like leafy greens, where you have production in the same areas during the same season, that limits complexity, and it's made it easier to do contracting in some of those crops than in others. So there's always a variety of factors that affect why contracts occur or don't occur, or how they were managed. Now, one of the things that can be done is you can have seasonal contracts, and that helps because prices change dramatically by season for some of the crops where you have a major change in production regions, especially if it's then offshore and it costs more to get the product to the market. You can have trigger prices so that if markets are short, the upside benefit is not totally lost by the shipper and the grower. And there are a variety of ways that they try to handle these things. So overall, the spot market is still very important, but we're developing other kinds of risk management tools, with contracting being one of them. Now, I just wanted to give you a feel for what prices can look like on a weekly basis, because you need to generally look at weekly prices in the world of fresh produce. And this is an example from the tomato industry. And I took this slide from data that I had done in 2003. I'd done this for various years, but it just gives you an example of what goes on in these markets. And first of all, you see that there's a lot of product differentiation in the tomato category. We have various kinds of tomatoes that are being sold in the U.S. market from various origins depending on the season of the year. And prices are generally higher in the wintertime. They begin to increase again in the fall. You see various significant changes even within the same region in pricing. For example, if you look at Mexican greenhouse tomato pricing in the winter, which is the blue line, you see that even though those prices are generally higher in the winter, there was a big dip there. And that's even though greenhouse production is occurring inside, but nevertheless, it's affected by the overall volume of fresh tomatoes on the market, most of which are still field grown. You can also notice that for mature green tomatoes, which are grown in California and in Florida, that their prices are generally lower than vine ripe tomato prices. And Mexico, for its field tomatoes, offers vine ripes, and it costs more to produce vine ripes, whether in California or in Mexico, and those buyers are willing to pay a higher price for those. They go into retail channels, whereas mature green tomatoes go into more food service channels. So you can see that I wanted to make that point here because it's true for many different imported products, and I think that there's a misconception that we're importing products in fresh produce because they're cheaper. In reality, most imported products are sold at a higher price in the U.S. market than products that are grown in the United States. The point is that we don't have enough supply at those times of the year, and that's why we're importing. Here you have an example of where there are production regions in Mexico and in the United States which are producing simultaneously. Florida with the Sinaloa region of Mexico in the winter, California with the state of Baja California in the summer and fall. But for many crops, there is no production in the United States during certain seasons of the year. Table grapes, tree fruit are great examples of that. Where we do not produce in the winter, that's why we are importing from Chile. But the broader context is you can see how difficult it is to try to manage something like this for forward contracts between growers, grower shippers or shippers and retailers, in particular when you consider the fact that growers are often located in just one region. And so the shipper is sourcing from various regions in order to have year-round supply. But growers may be based just in one region. So they may be averse to being included in a contract with a retailer, which is an average, lower average price for the season. How they may make their money is by being able to, for example, produce during the early season when prices are higher. So this has also influenced the relationships that some shippers have with how much of their own production they control. So for some grower shippers, as we move more to contracts in the tomato industry, that meant that they stopped sourcing from as many outside growers and started producing more themselves because for them, of course, what then they're interested in is the average price that they're getting at the end of the year. And they may figure if they can make a profit with that average price, then they're willing to have a lower contract price than what they might be getting during certain weeks of the year. But it may be a lot higher during the periods when markets are long. So if you look at this next slide, you see this is for all fresh tomatoes, U.S. grown fresh tomatoes, so it's aggregate tomato prices. You see the monthly volumes in this case, and you see them compared across time. But if you look at the right-hand side of the graph, you see the average prices for those years. And one of the things that I want to point out is that even when you have freezes in Florida in the winter, which dramatically impact prices, and what you see with the yellow line is the effects of a freeze in December of 1989 in the Florida tomato industry. You see that prices spike very quickly, but for annual crops, then growers replant, and then, of course, then you have a big glut of volume as that new production comes online. And so then prices will tend to decline very rapidly. Again, if you look at the end of this, the right side of the graph, or the yellow diamond that you see there, you see that the average price for 1990, despite this freeze, was very similar to what it was in 2000. Now, you also notice that for three of the years that the prices in the summer were very similar. On the other hand, you can see that in 2009 we had a big spike in the summer because of weather events. So all of that is certainly makes this industry complex. Now, over the last 25 years, we have gone to these year-round shippers. Buyers want that. They want more consistent supply from fewer firms. They wanted that even before food safety increased in importance. But with the advent of greater food safety concerns, they definitely have realized that they need to call suppliers and to work with only the suppliers that are meeting the strictest standards. But it also provides lower transaction costs for the buyer. So this is a trend that should remain in place. And, of course, it is a risk management tool for the shipper. Now, shippers have relationships with growers in specific regions for each crop, depending on where it can be grown at different times of the year, and they're trying to smooth out weekly production volumes. But nevertheless, they're still seeking out areas that have microclimates that they can identify for production, especially during the shoulders of the seasons where volumes are more precarious. And that remains a very important differentiation tactic for leading shippers. So they're looking all the time, whether it's a higher part of the Coachella Valley versus producing leafy greens in Yuma in the summer, in the winter, or whether it's trying to find a special part of the Baja California coast to grow a product that hasn't been grown there in the past. They're always looking for these microclimates. And one of the reasons is because that can help them be a more reliable supplier for buyers so that they don't short them, don't have to prorate them during the shoulder seasons, and that can help them gain business with buyers. It also can enable them to have more consistent quality. But you still are going to have these weather events that are going to create price volatility. All right, now, of course, imports have grown significantly in fresh produce because of the fact that shippers need to be providing products year-round to retailers, and, of course, importers play an important role in this as well, and you can see that our trade deficit for fresh produce has grown significantly from over the last decade and a half. This is something that, of course, has helped improve consumption because people have more products available year-round. Now, product diversification as a risk management tool has proved very challenging, and that's related to the technical production post-harvest and other constraints that are faced by producers. So 15, 20 years ago, people thought, well, okay, the retailers want year-round supply. It would be very good for them as well to have very wide line shippers. That would even further decrease their transaction costs. But really, it's very difficult for a tomato and a bell pepper and a melon shipper. Those are crops with similar types of handling requirements and seasons and regions. Very difficult for them to also operate, say, in the leafy green industry. And so this wide line of products has not really materialized within the industry. But it's very important for shippers to find a way to add value to products, even when they are not fresh-cut processors. And so packaging has become much more important in the industry as a product diversification trend. Larger packs for club stores is something that's really helped stimulate demand for a lot of different products. The shift to clamshells for the berry industry has had a major impact on stimulating demand. And then, of course, there's a lot of emphasis being placed today on breeding programs so that people can try to develop differentiated varieties of the same product so that you have better flavor, color, or other kinds of attributes. And I see that I'm getting close to my half an hour, so I'm going to kind of skip through some of these slides now. But I want to make a point about branding. That's something that we typically haven't had in the fresh produce industry, despite the fact that we're dealing with consumer-ready products. And it's very difficult to brand when you have intra and interseasonal differences in quality and quantity. If you can't be on the shelf year-round with a consistent product, you really can't create a consumer franchise. And that's especially hard in fresh produce because we have this perverse reality where usually when prices are highest, it's because of a supply event that diminished quality. So it's been hard to get consumer loyalty. Now, what has been changing is in the fresh cut sector, because in fresh cut, you're offering a consistent product year-round to consumers. You have dedicated shelf space. You have consistent pricing. On the other hand, in that sector specifically is where we've had the most private label growth within the fresh produce department recently. This is something that is creating a lot of competitive challenges for the fresh cut processing industry. Adding value, believe me, is not necessarily a panacea. Now, this whole idea of how you can better manage data to understand consumers in specific that are shopping in specific stores is something that can play a very important role in the future. And as retailers start to get a better handle on data, which they now can do because of product lookup codes, and there's the Perishables Group and IRI, two firms that are operating to sell scanner data that can be analyzed by suppliers so that they better understand what's happening at the retail level. As that unfolds, there's a real opportunity for shippers to differentiate themselves relative to other firms if they are investing in purchasing the scanner data and in analyzing it and in working with some of their key accounts to try to better understand the specific customers, consumers shopping in these different store formats for an individual chain. And so that's something that is called category development, and it's one of the trends that has come to the fresh produce industry late, but has really become a factor today and represents a major opportunity for shippers who are trying to become more competitive in what is still really pretty much a commodity industry. But to do this, you have to have scale. And so there's been a big trend towards consolidation at the shipper end of the system because in order to invest in what you need to have in terms of a marketing infrastructure that goes beyond selling but that really offers business intelligence requires larger volume, just as all of the other types of services that they are providing, including the major investments that they're making in food safety. So we have this this coming together of retailers and shippers to a greater extent than we did in the past, and retailers are more willing to share information with their suppliers now. Now it's not just Walmart because of the fact that they realize they need the shippers' help to better understand what's going on with an individual product category. And you may say, well, why doesn't the retailer know how to manage categories of products? But when you're looking at the fresh produce department, you have usually over 300 items. And in reality, the retailer is maybe not paying that much attention to your product. So you have a stake as a shipper to better manage how your product is handled on the retail shelf. And one of the things that represents a big opportunity is the area of promotional efficiency. And that's something I'd love to have more time to talk about, but I see that maybe we could engage more on that during the questions. If you can better understand consumer behavior with regard to specific products, then you can ship more the right volume and the right product to the right stores, and that can help you then to reduce shrink within the fresh produce value chain and create much more efficiency. So that's the opportunity over the next decade. And this is a slide that shows you some data from an individual retailer who was working on decreasing their shrink levels. This is a big push in the industry right now. And this retailer succeeded in bringing it down to about 4.5%, which is below average. It's common to have at least 6% shrink. When you add that up over all the stores that a retailer may own, that's millions of dollars in shrink. And really, in the past, the shipper has not understood the shrink for their products with individual retailers or with at the food retail level as a whole. And, of course, that is not the way the rest of the food system operates with consumer packaged goods. Suppliers are going to know about any shrink levels for their individual products. So a dairy supplier is going to know, a large processed frozen food supplier would know, but the fresh produce suppliers have not. So this is, again, another case where there's opportunities for retailers and shippers to come closer together and to try to better coordinate supply and demand. So I think I'm going to end at this point. And what you can see is that we still can't get away from the special challenges that exist in this industry, which are due to perishability that is not going to change, and the daily harvesting and shipping constraints. But regardless of these special challenges, fresh produce is increasingly being asked to conform to the standards of the CPG industry. So I appreciate your attention. And Ramiro, I don't know if we want to take a question at this point or not.
Thank you, Roberta. A lot of information, lots of information there. And yeah, we'll take one or two questions from the audience while we transition to Kinda's presentation. But I also want to remind the participants that the presentations are available in at the Ag in Uncertain Times website. And also to provide us with their email address so that we can contact them for future events. One question that came from the audience has to do with the spot market information, whether it is publicly available or only by subscription.
Yeah, spot market information comes from the USDA, from the Marketing Service, and that is publicly available, but because of the greater use of contracts, not as representative of pricing today as it would have been a decade ago. If you're looking at spot market prices, I would mention that it's important to look at FOB prices. When you look at wholesale market prices, that's really not very representative of volumes moved in the system because most products do not go through wholesale markets. They go directly from the shippers to final buyers. So FOB prices would be the best, and the FOB prices are available for specific regions when they are shipping. Of course, during the early season and the late seasons for a particular region, if there's not a lot of volume, they don't quote them. So you do have gaps, and it's not easy to deal with this data the way USDA has it, but they have been improving how they offer that data on the USDA website.
Thanks. One other question that just came in is about the role of social media in marketing fresh produce. Can you comment on that?
So social media is becoming much more significant. It's oftentimes, if you do want to offer a differentiated product, it can be difficult to manage that successfully in the marketplace, and most new products actually do not succeed. And one of the reasons is because while there may be demand for that product, it may be difficult to actually reach those consumers in an effective way in terms of targeting them and letting them know about the product and communicating with them. And that is changing now through the use of social media. And social media is being embraced by the more innovative shippers, and that does, again, represent opportunity for shippers who are not already engaged in this process. And also retailers are becoming much more involved, and so it does present many opportunities.
Thanks. Now, it is a pleasure to welcome our second speaker today. Dr. Kinda Curtis has been an associate professor and extension economist with the Department of Applied Economics at Utah State University since 2010. She completed a PhD in economics at Washington State University in 2003 and spent 7 years at the University of Nevada, Reno, as an assistant professor before moving to Utah State. Kinda's research interests include international agriculture and food marketing, consumer economics, and industrial organization. She has received several extension program awards from the Agricultural and Applied Economics Association and the Western Agricultural Economics Association. So, Kinda, thanks for joining us, and take it away.
Okay. Well, thank you, Romero. I'm going to be focusing today a little bit more on the types of things that people who are involved in direct marketing, so selling at farmers markets, community-supported agricultural programs, direct-to-restaurants, and those types of things. And so it's really a risk management issue, and I think that there are some different things that producers can do to reduce the volatility. Roberta mentioned that a lot of times the producers and shippers are price takers in the larger fruit and vegetable markets, and I think with the more direct markets, producers tend to have a little bit more impact on the prices that they receive by doing a few things like labeling, providing food safety, interacting with their customers, and those types of things. So really, one of the main things now is that many consumers are now focusing on purchasing local products. And we're seeing that especially in the growth rates of the numbers of farmers markets and community-supported agricultural programs around the country. Local harvest estimated that, you know, in 1990 we only had 90 CSAs across the country, and now we have close to 3,700. And so definitely reducing consumer uncertainty when they are purchasing products that are sold not traditionally in the grocery stores, to make sure that they're aware of how things have been produced, production technologies that have been used, food safety precautions, and stuff like that. When we reduce consumer uncertainty, we can have access to new markets for producers, potential to improve pricing, and, of course, reduce loss of consumer loss and reduce risk of revenue loss, but hopefully actually improve ability to bring in new customers and improve ability to improve pricing and revenues. So why are consumers uncertain about their food? Obviously, until the recent recession, there was a continued rising disposable household income. So people were eating away from the home quite often, and so they weren't involved in the food production process in the home, the food preparation process, and so they don't know how things are being prepared. They don't know what ingredients are being used, so they are more uncertain about the safety of that food. Also, as our population ages, they have much more health concerns and are looking for food that can improve their health. Also, we have had an increased number of food-related outbreaks in the last 20 years or so, including E. coli and salmonella. Also, we have new production technologies and crops that are genetically modified or pesticide, herbicide resistant, those types of things, and the potential effects to humans over time are unknown with that. And then finally, we have less than 2% of the population in the United States currently living on a farm, and only 17% actually living in rural areas. And so there's this growing separation between agricultural producers and consumers. Consumers just simply do not know where their food comes from. They don't know how it's produced, and so they're uncertain about those issues and also the environmental issues that arise from agricultural production. For example, we've had over 200 known diseases that are transmitted through food, and the Center for Disease Control, the CDC, estimates that we have 76 million illnesses, about a little over a quarter of a million hospitalizations, and 5,000 deaths resulting from food consumption annually. And you wouldn't normally think so, but fresh produce actually accounts for 5 of the top 10 riskiest foods regulated by the FDA, and so food safety is definitely a concern. Some of the major issues that come out in the press are usually things that have happened in restaurants, but they can happen in the home as well. Okay. One of the biggest issues for producers is the cost to them of being involved in some type of a food-related illness outbreak or a food safety incident or a recall. These are a couple of quotes The first one is from a publication done by the UC Davis Small Farm Firmer. The other one is from the general industry. But basically, due to the food safety scare with strawberries in 1996, the quote says that nearly 40 million was lost in sales, 5,000 jobs were lost, and there was a 10% reduction in the amount grown the following year. More recently, there was the peanut recall about a year and a half ago, and they were projecting to lose about $1 billion for small businesses, and that was the biggest food recall in U.S. history at that point. And so you can imagine how trying to provide a food safety plan, ensuring food safety, and letting your customers know for that can really help producers over time and prevent the loss of revenues and sales from being involved in an outbreak. Okay. On the pricing aspects, basically we are finding more dramatically in the last couple of years than originally. I started in 2000 studying these types of things, that consumers are willing to pay premiums for products that they think are safer, healthier, environmentally friendlier. And again, this is their perception. It's not necessarily that they are safer or healthier, but definitely natural, organic, reduced chemical inputs, things that have been food safety inspected, local foods that come from certain areas of origin, and people's definition of local can change over geographic area. Humane animal treatment, things that may be low fat, low sugar, high oxidants, so nutritional related issues, and then finally those particular producers who use social responsibility within their things. So we're seeing people willing to pay more for foods that have these things. Really, the issue, though, is that without a label or without information provided, they don't know that these things have happened. And so a lot of what producers need to do is just to show that they've used these production technologies and stuff like that. So anyway, I want to talk about three tools. The first one is to put in a food safety management plan. And I'll talk a little bit more just for basic fruit and vegetable production, and then I'll talk briefly about one that can also be used for those producers who are also doing some processing of their products, say doing jellies and jams and breads and those types of things. Some product labeling and certification programs that are available, and then how you might establish a rapport with consumers and give them the information about your production processes and those types of things through consumer education and events. Okay. Just briefly, I'm not going to go into detail of these, but just some of the food safety risks are out there. There's three main. There's biological, chemical, and physical. And if you've ever visited large vegetable production area, you'll notice that they are very, very into trying to limit the physical things that might happen within the production area. You know, you can't wear jewelry. You have to come on and off the field in a certain way and those types of things. And so for biological, basically we have various bacteria, viruses, parasites, those types of things. Allergens also fall into biological risks. For chemical and physical risk, we have metals, agrochemicals, stone, sticks, metal, okay, and also things that employees might bring in, such as pens, pencils, jewelry, those types of things. So those are the general risks that we're trying to avoid. And there are some blanket food safety management plans that are available. The first one is GAP, or the Good Agricultural Practices. This was established in a cooperation between the Food and Drug Administration and the U.S. Department of Agriculture in 1998. And it is a farm-level voluntary program. It's not yet required. And basically, you can have someone come out and do an audit. And I'll talk a little bit more about that on the next slide. Basically, there's a good handling practice audit verification checklist, which you can download. And there are a number of questions in several different categories, such as what water source are you using, how are you using it on your crop, what are you doing with manure and municipal biosolids, what type of worker health and hygiene practices are you using, what type of field and harvest sanitation, how is post-harvest water being eliminated, what type of transportation are you using, and then what kind of storage and distribution. And so it's about a three-page long questionnaire, and it has anywhere from 3 to 5 questions under each of these categories. Another potential food safety plan, this is a leafy greens marketing agreement, which was established in California after the 2006 spinach outbreak. And so this is more of a regional one. There are some people in Nevada and Arizona who also belong to this, but and there may be similar marketing agreements across the country that you could belong to. And basically they establish a set of food safety procedures. And some of them are similar to the GAP. And some of them are quite different, and they're more focused on people who produce certain types of things, and so it's probably more appropriate, like if you were just doing leafy greens, this type of program would be probably more appropriate than just going with good agricultural practices, but it really depends on the situation. For those producers who are also doing processing of their products, perhaps, especially to keep sales during the winter, being able to process things so that there's less loss during the high season. HACCP, the Hazard Analysis and Critical Control Points, is a possibility. This was adopted by the FDA to basically regulate food production industries, and it's a prevention-based program. Basically, you will identify various places where there might be the possibility of having a contamination spot, and so that's basically identifying critical control points, and then basically preventative measures are established, monitoring procedures, corrective actions, verification procedures, and then, of course, record keeping to go along with it. One thing with HACCP, I know in Utah, it is possible for producers to actually do some processing in their homes. We have the cottage processing program. I know that is not available in many other states, and so many producers are using commercial kitchens, and if you're using a commercial kitchen, they will already have a HACCP plan in place. For just basic fruit and vegetable production, probably HACCP is not going to be as appropriate as, say, GAP or working with a marketing agreement like the Leafy Greens marketing agreement. Okay. There was a question I see up here, and I just wanted to address that a little bit, in that in order for a local grower to essentially access a local grocery store, there are some requirements. And this is for a large grocery chain that operates in California, Nevada, and they also buy locally. And as you can see, they require farm business plan, land use history, water irrigation system description, pesticide application records, employee food safety training schedule, and HACCP or other similar food safety plan, harvest transportation methods, record keeping, et cetera. And so in order for smaller growers to sell to local grocery stores, obviously having a valid business plan, good records, and a food safety plan is a necessary part of entering that market. Again, a lot of smaller growers are just using farmers markets, CSAs, those types of things, and that. But I know a lot of the grocery stores are now wanting to bring in local products because they're being demanded by their consumers, and so these are some of the requirements that they have. And this particular grocery outlet requires all of these things, not just some of them. The next possibility is to enter into a product labeling or certification program, and you would be labeling for various production systems such as organic, grass-fed. Okay, you could also label for food origin. There are usually regional and state programs. I know most of the western states have programs such as Oregon Grown, Utah's Own, Nevada Grown, Made In, all those types of things. And so those programs are actually very cost-effective, too. I know some of the fees are only like $30 a year to be part of that, and they provide a label so that consumers know where your food is being produced. Also, country of origin labeling is required at the retail level. And then there's also some food safety inspection certification labeling methods, which I already discussed, that are available. Some of the benefits of using these labels, we've seen in various literature across the last 5 to 7 years, that people are basically willing to pay premiums when they see different types of labels, whether it be for grass-fed, whether it be for organic, whether it be for antibiotic-free. And it's not just in the research stage. We've actually seen that on the ground in actual purchasing behavior at this point. There's a lot of programs that are done by third parties, and basically they allow the producer to enter this organized marketing program. And basically the third party does the examination, looks at the records, and so consumer can be a little more, what's the word I should use, a little more assured that the fact that it is organic or it is a certain production process has been used, and that's the third party program. Basically, third parties will set standards, so some of the quality level. They will test and inspect on an annual basis. They will provide labels to their certified producers, and they also do enforcement. And so a consumer can go online, look at that third party's program and see what producers are still part of that program, have they been inspected, if there was an issue, has it been corrected, and they can use those websites to find out more information. It is also possible, though, to basically label first party, make a direct claim about the products, and we see that with healthy, homegrown, those types of things. Also, organic growers who have less than $5,000 in sales annually are exempt from doing organic certification, but can mention that they have organic, used organic production methods. There aren't any set standards, but producers are still held to truth in labeling laws, and so that's an issue. It's not advisable to say something that isn't true, but I think that as even though consumers tend to prefer to see a third-party label, as you develop relationships with your consumers, the first-party label may be just as effective and probably less expensive. Branding is another possibility. We don't see that as much in the fruit and vegetable industry, but there are some successful examples here. And again, a brand takes time to develop, and things have to be around every day. They can't just come and go. Okay. But anyway, whether you look at first-party labeling or look at third-party labeling, obviously the benefits and the cost have to be compared, and it's probably good to do so over a multiple time horizon. I know a lot of organic growers in the arid regions of Nevada and Utah have decided not to certify. They're just telling consumers that they're using organic methods, but they're not labeling it, and so they feel that they're getting more price premium basically for being local than for certifying organic at this point. Some of the benefits of third-party programs, of course, higher prices for goods, increased market access, and hopefully price stabilization. But the costs, you have to pay a certification, some places as much as $1,500, depending on the situation. You have to do record keeping, you have to do marketing, those types of things. As example, some of the minimum record keeping requirements that there are for third-party certification is all planting, spraying, and harvesting, handling, cleaning, washing activities, all transportation activity, cleaning and transportation equipment. Imagine the record keeping to do this would be extensive. Okay. The third possibility, and I don't say that they should be used separately, but perhaps in conjunction with each other, is to provide educational information and events. Brochures, signs at farmers markets, and other marketing materials can be used to demonstrate product nutritional benefits, special farm production methods, food safety procedures, the food safety plan that you have on your farm, and then any energy conservation or environmental conservation planning you're doing. I think that these work really well in brochures at farmers market stands. Another thing that we've seen more often, I think, with CSA is community supported agricultural programs, is that the group of farmers working together to provide the basket also provide educational newsletters and programming for their members, and a lot of that has to do with safe handling, whether it be fruits and vegetables or meat and poultry, appropriate cooking temperatures, times, how to storage and handle foods, and then, of course, home gardening production methods. We've seen that a lot of the consumers who are involved in CSA programs or who shop at farmers markets are also home gardeners, and providing information on how they can produce products successfully in their area is a good thing. And it's not that they home garden so they don't buy from the producer anymore. It's just that they really appreciate, especially when they're trying to grow in an area that's difficult, like we see, especially in Nevada and Utah. And so that is what I had prepared for today, and I want to thank Ramiro for having me, and I'll turn it back over to him.
Thank you, Kinda. A lot of information. I just want to clarify on your first-party labels. In California, I believe producers are required to, regardless of sales volume, are required to register with the State Department of Ag to be able to market as organic. The exemption apply only to the federal certification process.
Yeah, and that is not the case in Utah. They are not required to certify, and they're not required to register if they're less than 5,000 in sales.
Yeah, I believe we are the only state that does that.
Yeah. Also, the requirements for doing processing are very different by state. The requirements for doing food sampling at farmers markets are different by state, and so depending on which state the producer is, they really need to investigate those requirements in their individual state, because there's not really any consistency that I can see, at least looking at the three or four states that I've been involved in.
We have lots of questions that have come in, and I want to thank our speakers today, but a few questions for Kinda. Do you anticipate a continued growth in demand for local foods, and if so, are there regional differences?
Yes, I anticipate continued growth, and I was very happy to see that continued growth during our economic recession. The consumers who are especially focused on using these outlets to purchase their food, so farmers markets, these types of things, definitely have a concern for their health, their children's health, and want to know where their food comes from, and I don't think that that's going to change anytime soon. Consumers can be fickle and change fads quickly. This one seems to be gaining ground over the last 10 years and probably will continue. There is regional differences in local food demand, but we are seeing growth in these outlets across the United States, and there doesn't seem to be areas that are not involved in this change in where consumers buy.
Okay, we have a couple questions. Roberta, are you on?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to ask the question, and perhaps you two can comment on it. And it has to do with food safety issues and whether they limit small producers from entering or participating in the produce markets. What can you guys tell us about that?
Yeah, I can comment on that. That's something that has been an issue that is receiving a lot more attention within the broader fresh produce industry in recent years, because demand for locally grown is definitely increasing. And so that means that you have more smaller producers in different parts of the country that are now engaged in mainstream distribution channels. And as a result of that, what's happened is that retailers who are marketing those products have come under growing attention with regard to whether or not they're actually requiring the same food safety methods of their small producers that they do of large producers. And in general, that's not been the case, because there are issues with regard to food safety and implementation of GAPs that are very expensive, and it's difficult for someone who's only producing for a very short season to be able to implement. So in order to address that, one of the things that has happened is that the retailers themselves, like Wegmans in the Northeast is a good example of that, and other retailers are starting to develop programs to work with the growers who they are sourcing from during just a short season in their local or regional area. And so I think that that will improve over time, and the idea that if you're small, you don't have to meet the same requirements, I think is something that will probably go by the wayside over the next 5 years or so. I think people who are going to be participating in mainstream channels, so going beyond selling at a farmer's market, for example, I think over time they will be assisted so that they can come up to a similar level of larger producers. And the other thing that I think will help them to achieve that is that, of course, the grower shippers are the ones that are consolidating supply from different regions, as I mentioned. So as locally grown products have developed, especially during the summer season in the Midwest and the East and the Northeast, the shippers that are based in California for those crops are seeing an opportunity to market that production
because they have the marketing infrastructure. And so there's more interest among those shippers in working with growers in other parts of the country, and they're helping to transfer some of that technology as well.
Thanks. Any comments, Kinda?
I completely agree with Roberta that I think that the grocery stores are going to start having small growers also adhere to their food safety requirements. And I know that a couple of grocery stores that we used to work with in the Reno area actually phased out their local buying programs because they were unsuccessful at bringing in producers who could adhere to their requirements. Thank you.
One last question. I think it is important for the two topics that you both covered. It has to do with regional differences. Are there any differences that stand out, Roberta, from your perspective, and Kinda, also from your local food production perspective in the U.S.? Are there dramatic differences regionally?
In terms of how the products are marketed or consumer demand?
Or trends overall?
Uh-huh. So, Kinda, you can give your perspective on that. I would just briefly comment first that I think that the regionally some of the most important factors that contribute to differences are availability of what can be produced in those areas. So if you're located in the South, for example, you're going to have certain kinds of products available to you locally during the summer that you're in areas. And so I think that interest is there among consumers in much of the country today, but availability is what varies very widely. On the other hand, too, you can say that always consumer interest in major trends tends to start on the coast, especially California. So a lot of these trends towards interest in locally grown did tend to emerge first in the whole western coast, including Washington, Oregon, California, and are very important in the east as well. But they're really becoming much more mainstream, I would say, now in the United States. How would you respond to that, Kinda?
Yeah, I would agree. I think that we see more use of farmers markets and CSAs, local demand, also within our cities. Of course, those people tend to be a little bit higher on the income scale, have more disposable income, and also they don't have the gardens and the land space that people more in the rural areas have, and so they are purchasing these local foods within the city. We do not see quite as many farmers markets in rural areas, although I have to say in my experience we did have growth in rural farmers markets within Nevada while I was there. But they were tended to be small, two or three providers instead of 15 to 30 providers at the farmers market.
Thank you, both Roberta and Kinda. Lots of good information and a lot of questions left for you guys, but for the sake of time, and we'll end it right here. We appreciate your presentations, and want to remind participants that both these presentations will be available in our website. What is next is the question that many of us ponder, and perhaps you too. And as I mentioned earlier, we are going to be sending a survey asking you for feedback and also asking you to evaluate this webinar series. We want your input, and we appreciate those of you who have provided your emails. You will be receiving an email within the next 2 weeks probably. And I want to let you know that we're also planning additional webinars for next spring. We're also considering doing some of these in Spanish as well. And if you're interested in being notified of these webinars, please send us an email to the westrme@wsuedu address. I want to also alert you that you can use some of these materials in your local programming. Our website, again, has all recordings of our webinars, presenters, slide sets. list of the speakers and contact information, and also discussion of webinar topics. It is an exceptional resource, and we encourage you to make a good use of it. Additionally, some of the presenters today had to omitted some of their slides, and the full slide sets are going to be available at that website as well. We would like you to let us know what area of topic or topic in mentioned in today's webinar would you like to see covered in future webinars, or any additional topics that you would like us to address. You can either use the chat pod to the left or send us an email and let us know. And we are going to upload a file that has all the links to the website and information resources discussed today. We encourage you to download it. That way you have it all in one page, and bookmark it, or bookmark the sites that may be of interest to you, and continue to use the information that was presented. With that, I don't have any other comments. I thank you all for participating. Thank our speakers for excellent presentations, and thank you to the team for putting this together. Have a good day.